Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Meditation Studio. I'm Patricia Karpis. In this series, we introduce you to real people with extraordinary stories and experts who share how meditation and mindfulness practices change our lives. Our podcast is brought to you by Meditation Studio. Apple's pick is one of the 10 best apps of the year. Why download the app? Because life is messy. We get stressed, anxious, have trouble sleeping, we work too hard, we deal with conflict, we grieve, our hearts get broken, we worry about the state of the world. We meditate because we're human. Our app gives you hundreds of meditations from over 30 leading experts. It helps a lot. And you can now enjoy 8 free meditations on Alexa. Just ask her to enable Meditation Studio. And join us on Facebook for our Meditation Studio Daily Facebook group, where we're getting together to share our meditation experiences. Today's guest is Dr. Joe Dispenza, a New York Times bestselling author, researcher, and educator driven by the conviction that each of us has the potential for greatness and unlimited abilities, including the ability to heal ourselves. Dr. Joe also trained as a chiropractor. He shares how he healed himself after a devastating bike accident that damaged his spine, and he discusses some things that may stretch our current belief systems a bit, but at the end of the day, he's presenting tools and techniques that he says can change our lives. His real passion is at the intersection of the latest findings from the fields of neuroscience, epigenetics, and quantum physics to explore the science behind spontaneous remissions. Get ready for some pretty interesting out-of-the-box thinking. Now, here's Dr. Joe Dispenza. So, Dr. Joe Dispenza, it's such a pleasure to have you on Untangle today.
I'm very happy to be with you, Patricia.
Yeah. Can you start by giving us a little bit of your backstory? I'd love for our listeners to hear about the accident and what inspired you to first discover the power of your own practice.
Well, I think that for some of us to wake up, we need a wake-up call. And in 1986, I got the call. I was in a triathlon in Palm Springs, California, and I was on the biking portion of a race. And there was a police officer on the corner waving me on, and he had his back to the oncoming traffic. And I was passing two cyclists on the corner. And as I passed those cyclists, because the police officer wasn't looking, a four-wheel drive Bronco going very fast hit me from behind and catapulted me out of my bike. And I wound up breaking 6 vertebrae in my spine. And when you land that hard on your back or your bottom, the compression, you know, the force of compression crushes the vertebrae. So when you compress that volume of material, bone fragments have to go somewhere. So they went back on my spinal cord, and the eighth thoracic vertebrae, the arch that the spinal cord passes through, had broken like a pretzel. So I had multiple compression fractures of my thoracic spine and upper lumbar spine. I had bone fragments on my spinal cord, and I had the neural arch of the eighth thoracic vertebrae compressing the cord. So the typical procedure for an accident like this is a surgery called the Harrington rod surgery. And that's where they cut off the back parts of your vertebrae. It's called a laminectomy. And in my case, it would be from the base of my neck to the base of my spine, and then screw in these stainless steel rods. And as they screw the rods in, it acts as a cantilever to pull the bone fragments off the cord. And then they cut your buttocks open. They take bone fragments from your hip, and they paste it over the top of your spine, and they hope for the best. And so I was facing a serious injury, possible wheelchair for the rest of my life. And I had 4 opinions from 4 of the leading surgeons in Southern California, and they were adamant that surgery was the only option. So I decided against the surgery because I thought the risk was worth it. And I decided that I wasn't going anywhere or doing anything. I was basically laying face down. And I had this thought that I kept having in my mind that the power that made the body heals the body, the power that made the body heals the body. And I just thought, God, if this power is an intelligence and it's a consciousness, and consciousness is awareness, and awareness is paying attention, it must be paying attention to me. So I can't heal myself, but if I could create a plan, a design, if I could give it a very clear picture of what I wanted, and when I was satisfied with that picture and present with this ever-present consciousness, maybe I could surrender this model to a greater mind, and maybe it could begin to do the healing for me. And I'm going to tell you, it wasn't easy, because I think when you're in crisis or you have a trauma like that, we tend to focus on what we don't want to have happen instead of what we do want to have happen. So it was very difficult first six weeks of my life, because I couldn't get my mind to do what I wanted it to do. I'd start off reconstructing my vertebrae, and then the next thing you know, I'd be thinking about living in a wheelchair, if I should sell my home or my practice. And I kept going back to the fact that I was focusing on what I didn't want to have happen. So then I get frustrated, and I get impatient, and I get angry, then it would get worse. And you know how that goes. So I went through a dark night of the soul, and at the end of about 6 or 7 weeks, I went through the whole entire internal process without losing my focus. And I felt like I hit a tennis ball in the sweet spot. Something clicked after that, and I started noticing very profound changes in my health and my body. And I knew the moment I started feeling better that what I was doing inside of me was producing an effect outside of me. What took me 2 or 3 hours to do, to go through the entire process, it took me about 45 minutes, and I was firing and wiring those circuits, and certainly practicing the skill of paying attention. And I was back on my feet in 10 and a half weeks. I was back into my life at training and practicing again at 12 weeks. And I just made a deal with myself. And that was, if I was ever able to walk again, I'd spend the rest of my life studying the mind-body connection and mind over matter. And for the most part, that's what I've been doing since 1986.
That's such an incredible story. I mean, did you have any, no, you're a chiropractor, but had you had any experience with this sort of deep visualization and healing work before you said, okay, I'm not going to do this surgery, I am going to do this myself? I mean, that's a pretty aggressive choice. Yeah.
Well, in 1986, I can tell you that it wasn't very common to say no to a physician. I think I was just young and innocent enough and fearless enough to say, well, God, if I'm going to be in a possible wheelchair anyway, why not take the risks? I had done a lot of yoga. I had always believed in human potential, but I kind of was making it up as I was going along. The reasoning behind it made sense to me, and I was weighing what I knew against what I didn't know. I think when you don't know, you step into the unknown. And if you're willing to kind of ride that horse, I think magic can actually happen.
Yeah, let's talk about this sort of idea of stepping into the unknown, because you really were doing that, but you were also doing some kind of meditation, right? Would you call it at that stage, would you have called it like a visualization, meditation, manifestation?
Yeah.
You were intentionally trying to make something happen.
Mm-hmm. I think it was, first of all, I think it was a meditation. I don't think I called it that at that time, because I think it's natural for us when we reach a certain point where we reach the end of our emotional belief, or we're beat up by our environment, or we paint ourselves into a corner, that it's kind of this natural thing that we do where we just close our eyes and we want to disconnect from our outer world. You know, we don't get up and do as many things. We sit still, we go inward, and we lose track of space and time. And that inner process of what I was doing was, I was reconstructing those vertebrae, but I was working on some of the principles that I think we innately do anyway when we really want to begin to embark on some type of change. It's just that I didn't do it once or twice. I just kept doing it because I had to produce some type of outcome. So I think in a sense, it is a type of meditation. I can explain it from a meditative model, because after I had my own personal transformation, I started studying people with spontaneous remissions, and they had done very similar things that I had done. And so that's what allowed me to begin to build a model of this concept that I teach. And then I said, well, gosh, if I found the similarities of hundreds and hundreds of people that have healed from serious health conditions, gosh darn it, maybe we could do it on well people. And maybe this is the model of change and transformation. And so it was kind of this process of exploration. And as I started studying the science behind it, I think it kind of merged with a lot of principles that people practice in their own personal meditative processes.
Yeah. And I mean,
we'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is "Take comfort in Born shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
I do focus a lot on science, neuroscience, epigenetics. What scientific data can you discuss that sort of proves that this process, and maybe you can talk a little bit more about the process, kind of changes our biology, that it is a model for change and transformation?
Well, you know, the whole reason I started measuring and doing our own scientific experiments is because we were witnessing people in a weekend workshop with MS or lupus or rheumatoid arthritis or chronic pain or Hashimoto's syndrome or anxiety or depression or whatever it was, even rare genetic disorders, all of a sudden start having some type of physiological change. And when it happens once, it's an incident. If it happens twice, it's a coincidence. But if it starts happening over and over again, you're looking at a trend, and anything that's repeatable really is science. So I started taking those measurements because I wanted to see what was going on in the inner workings of the brain and body. So we've done probably over 8,000 brain scans. We've measured people that come to a workshop for 4.5 days. We measure their brain before they start the workshop. At the end of four and a half days, we measure their brain again. And I want to see the changes aren't just in their mind, they're in their brain. We've measured numerous, you know, thousands of people in real time in the process of a meditation. And I can tell you without a doubt that you and I are at our absolute best when we get beyond ourselves. And that's the work.
Yeah.
We've measured greater levels of coherence in the brain, super coherence, I would call it, greater enormous amounts of energetic changes, more energy in the brain. Some of those energy changes have never been recorded in the history of neuroscience. We've measured more wholeness and more organization in different compartments of the brain when a person begins to do the work, their frontal lobe turns on, and that's the seat of our conscience and awareness. We've seen very significant changes in things like traumatic brain injuries and cyclic mood problems and Parkinson's disease, significant changes.
Well, can you just describe, because I know, you know, I always feel a little nervous about giving people such great hope, and yet you have such great science behind this. And maybe there's a way that you can kind of describe the style of meditation and what's actually happening, because, you know, we talk on this podcast a lot about mindfulness and compassion mm-hmm. practices and gratitude practices and loving kindness. But you're defining meditation in a different way than we talk about it here.
Well, sure. So the word meditation actually means to become familiar with. That's what, when I've done the research, if you look at the symbol, the ancient symbols of meditation, to know thyself, to cultivate self, and to become familiar with. And so I believe that your personality creates your personal reality, and your personality is made up of how you think, how you act, and how you feel. So the present personality who's listening on this call has created the present personal reality called their life, which means if you want to change your life, if you want to change your personal reality, you got to change your personality, which means you got to start thinking about what you've been thinking about and become conscious of your unconscious habits and behaviors. And notice and observe those emotions that keep you connected to the past and decide, do these emotions belong in my future? And I think that most people try to create a new personal reality as the same personality, and it doesn't work. So if you think 60 to 70,000 thoughts in one day, and 90% of those thoughts are the same thoughts as the day before,
right?
Same thoughts lead to the same choices. Same choices lead to the same behaviors. Same behaviors create the same experiences. Same experiences produce the same emotions. And those same emotions tend to influence our very same thoughts. And our biology, our neurocircuitry, our neurochemistry, our hormones, and even our genetic expression stays the same. So if you keep doing that over and over again, the redundancy of that process of firing and wiring the same circuits in the same way over time begins to hardwire the brain into a very finite signature. that box in the brain becomes our identity. And by the time we're 35 years old, we become a set of memorized behaviors, unconscious habits, automatic emotional reactions, beliefs, perceptions, hardwired attitudes that function like a computer program, almost subconsciously. So then to become familiar with those unconscious states of mind and body, it begs the question, if you're observing your thoughts, who's doing the observing of your thoughts? That's when you're not the program. That's consciousness. That's mindfulness. That's metacognition. So then the more you become conscious of your unconscious thoughts, behaviors, and emotions, the less unconscious you'll go during the day because you're no longer immersed in the program. So then as you become more familiar with those states of mind and body, the less likely you'll go unconscious. So the first step in change is knowing thyself. So the second part is actually the creative process, which is what thoughts do you want to fire and wire in your brain? What behaviors do you want to demonstrate in one day, one lifetime? And the act of rehearsing your behaviors, planning your actions, the act of doing that begins to install the neurological hardware in your brain to look like the experience has already happened. Now you're priming your brain, and if you keep doing it enough times, that hardware will become a software program, and you'll start thinking like a compassionate person. You'll begin to act in more friendly and happy ways. And then the last step, of course, can you teach your body emotionally what that future is going to feel like before it's made manifest? Which means you can't wait for your health to feel wholeness and gratitude. You can't wait for your success to feel abundance and worthiness. You can't wait for your new relationship to feel love. That's kind of the old model of reality, of waiting for something outside of us to give us relief, to change how we're feeling inside of us. And what if it never happens? We spend our whole life living in separation and lack. And it's kind of the Newtonian model of reality. The quantum model of reality is about causing an effect, which means the moment you start feeling wholeness and gratitude, your healing begins. The moment you start loving yourself and loving life, you start creating equals. The moment you start generating worthiness and abundance, you'll create success. And now that's causing an effect. So then if you keep trading guilt and fear and shame for love, compassion, gratitude, and freedom, and you keep doing it over and over again, it'll begin to become familiar to you. And if you keep rehearsing who you're going to be when you open your eyes, and you keep doing it over and over again, it'll become more familiar to you. So the first model of meditation is about becoming familiar with. The second model is that the whole purpose of meditation is to get beyond the analytical mind. And what separates the conscious mind from the subconscious mind is our analytical mind. So then it's pretty amazing because our research shows that when you analyze your life within some disturbing emotion that's derived from the hormones of stress, without a doubt, you'll make your brain worse because you're thinking in the past. Mm-hmm. When people finally get over that emotion, then all of a sudden, the memory without the emotional charge is called wisdom, and now they're ready for the next experience. So then we teach people how to change their brainwaves, and we had to slow them down. And so when you're living in stress and you're living in survival, you narrow your focus on matter, on people, on things, on places, on your body, and on time itself, because the body and brain are aroused. And so in order for people to begin to change their brainwaves, they have to understand that when they're in that state, they're in a very high aroused state called high beta brainwaves. And so if you teach a person, instead of to go from a narrow focus to an open focus and begin to focus on nothing, on space, to go from a convergent focus to a divergent focus, the act of doing that begins to not only slow their brainwaves down, but produce more coherent brainwaves. Now, all of a sudden, the brain starts to synchronize. And as the brainwaves go slower, they move beyond their analytical mind. The brain becomes more coherent. And now they're in the operating system where 95% of those subconscious states exist. And they can begin to make changes, which means the thinking brain, normal thinking conscious brain, can't change the program. You got to slow the brain waves down to get into that operating system. So that's the second principle. The third principle is that if you're living aroused 70% of the time by those stress hormones, it also makes sense that you're just thinking about three things. The arousal of those chemicals cause you to put your attention on your body. Why? That's adaptive. If you're being chased by Tyrannosaurus Rex, you better be thinking about your body and putting your attention on it. When the stress hormones are activated because you're perceiving a danger or a threat in your outer world, you put your attention on your outer environment and what your outer environment made of. made up of bodies and people and things and places. And if you're, you know, if you're being chased by a predator, you're also preoccupied with time. So then in order to be, really begin to heal your body by thought alone or create an outcome in your life by thought alone, then you have to become thought alone. So take your attention off your environment, take your attention off your body, and that's the moment you become pure consciousness. And that's when you begin to connect to a field of information called the quantum field, where all possibilities exist. And now the person's gotten beyond themselves, and we can actually predict when that happens on a brain scan now, and we can actually teach it, and people can get good at it like a skill.
My name's Dwayne Osterlin. I'm host of the Addicted Mind podcast. Are you ready to uncover the science of breaking addiction? Then join me on the Addicted Mind, where compassion meets innovation. We're going to explore real stories of addiction recovery, hear from real experts on science-based treatment, and you'll be able to equip yourself with the tools for lasting change. So whether you're on the road to recovery yourself or walking alongside someone who is, the Addicted Mind podcast is your companion. So check it out. Subscribe on whatever podcast app you're using right now and be part of the conversation that's changing lives.
You take your attention off of matter. Like, the hormones of stress cause us to become materialists and to define reality with our senses. So then we're focusing on matter. But the quantum model of reality is both matter and energy, particle and wave.
Right.
So then the nature of the way we've been habituated is to focus on matter, focus on the rose, focus on the computer, focus on the candle, focus on the car, focus on the cell phone, because that's where most of our attention is, on three-dimensional reality. So then matter has a very difficult time changing matter. It takes a long time for matter to change matter because you got to play by the laws of Newtonian physics. So then if you go from a narrow focus, that means focusing your attention in a narrow way on something material, and you close your eyes and you do the actual opposite. You open your focus and create what's called a divergent focus. You're actually sensing energy and information and sensing space. And the act of opening your focus and tuning into energy and space is not an act of visualization. It's an act of awareness. The quantum field always exists, but if you don't put any attention on it, then it doesn't exist for you. So then you can't experience the quantum field with your senses. You experience three-dimensional reality with your senses. You can only experience that field with your awareness. So then becoming consciousness, becoming awareness, means you have to take your attention off of everything material. So then as you open your focus and you sense energy and information, you begin to slow your brain waves down, and the act of doing that begins to allow you to connect to a field of information that creates orderliness and wholeness in the body, because that's the intelligence, self-organizing intelligence of the unified field. So that's the process that creates more brain coherence, more heart coherence, genetic changes, stimulates the immune system. We've measured all of that. So that's the process.
So how do we get to a place where we can trust the unknown sort of over this material physical world that we live in all the time so that we can tap into that?
Well, it takes practice, number one. It takes knowledge and information. I think we have to create a model for people to realize that the unknown is not a scary place. The unknown is actually where the magic happens. They said if you're living in survival, though, you're living in fear, you're living in anger, you're living in sadness, people cling to the known, which means they'd rather hang on to their guilt than take a chance and possibility. They'd rather cling to their story of their past than tell another story of their future. They'd rather believe in their past more than they believe in their future. So it takes knowledge. It takes practice. It takes repetition. It takes it takes building that model and then keep allowing the person to re-experience it. And the feedback that we use in the measurements allows people to know, hey, I'm doing it or I'm not doing it. And when we show them their scans and we show them that they're actually doing it, they'll keep doing what they're doing. And if we show them that they're not doing it, then we give them the feedback to help them get better at it. And so now people can change their brainwaves that have been practicing in 4 seconds and 5 seconds and 9 seconds and 11 seconds, 12 seconds. It's not like I'm getting there before you. It's just become a skill. And now they know how to do it.
So they would have to sort of learn this process with you.
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I think we're wired to do this. I think we're wired to do this. I think the hardest part of all of this really is making the time to do it and not wait for crisis or trauma or disease or diagnosis to do it. You know, do it in a state of joy and inspiration. So I always say you have one of two choices. either you're defined by the memory of the past or you're defined by a vision of the future. And if you're defined by the memory of the past, you wake up every morning and you think about your problems, and those problems are connected to the memories of certain people and things at certain times and places. And those memories create emotions, because emotions are the end product of experiences. And so the brain is a record of the past.
Yep.
And feelings and emotions are the end product of past experiences. So the moment you remember your problems and you feel unhappy and sad and guilty, now your brain and body are completely in the past. And so how you think and how you feel creates your state of being. Most people's entire state of being is in the past, which means for the most part, they'll be predictable in their life. And if they keep thinking and feeling and feeling and thinking the same way, they hardwire the brain into a very finite signature, and they condition their body emotionally into the past. And now we can't go to a future because the body and brain are living in the past. So getting people beyond their past, dragging them into the present moment, mm-hmm. and teaching them how to do this properly allows them all of a sudden to begin to see new possibilities. You can't see those possibilities when you're viewing your future through the lens of the past. So then when you combine a clear intention with an elevated emotion, we've all done this. You start thinking about what's possible, and yep. you start emotionally responding to those thoughts. And now all of a sudden you're moving into a new state of being, and all of a sudden you start seeing new possibilities. But your job then is not to just do it for a second and then go back to feeling angry and frustrated. You just return back to the past. You got to maintain that modified state of being for an extended period of time. And if you do, you'll see changes in your biology. You'll see changes in your genes. You'll see changes in your neurocircuitry. You'll see changes in how your heart works, your brain works, your immune system. And all of a sudden, you'll start seeing changes in your life. And they'll come in ways that you can't expect. That's the unknown. There'll be surprises. There'll be synchronicities, opportunities, coincidences. And the moment you start seeing the feedback in your life, you'll start paying attention to what you did to create it, and you'll keep doing it again. All of a sudden, we move from a victim in our life saying, that person's making me feel this way, or this is why I'm this way, to becoming creator of our life. And that's when we start waking up a little bit more.
I love that. I love what you say about setting a clear intention with an elevated emotion. And one of your fans, someone I know that's been to many of your workshops, who actually introduced me to you, which I was so happy about, was talking about this idea of what to do when you wake up and you want to do your meditation, you want to set your intention, you want to reach that place of an elevated emotion, but you start off in a very negative, stuck way. Is there a way to sort of shake that, or do you just not meditate that day?
No. Listen, I mean, that's what natural does. That's normal. You know, I didn't feel it today. Well, that's because you're addicted to that emotion. And so my question is, once you get beyond that emotion and condition your body to a new mind, you'll be so happy that you're happy. So then if you get up from your meditation feeling the same way that you started, nothing happened. Nothing happened neurologically, biologically, chemically, hormonally, genetically, energetically. You're still in that same state of being. So what do we do? So there's certain disciplines, certain techniques that we teach. One of them I talk about in the new book, Becoming Supernatural, is literally a breath that we use to pull the mind out of the body. Now, we've measured thousands of people doing this breath, and it begins to liberate energy, and that energy begins to create more coherence in the brain. That energy begins to create more energy in the brain. The life force is moving back to the brain, and the person's freeing themselves from the chains of the past. And if they can move guilt into joy with the breath, they've overcome some aspect of their past. So we use different modalities, different ways to get people beyond it. And what I always tell people, the people who do their meditation in spite of not doing it, those are their best meditations, because they're not expecting anything, but they just go into it and they just, they trust. And so it takes a little bit more a teaching, but gosh darn it, that's what makes us supernatural. You got to start doing what feels unnatural. And if you keep doing it over and over again, you will become supernatural.
So you said there were three things, and the first was the breath to pull the mind out of the body. What were the other two things?
We do a specific way of teaching people how to find the generous present moment.
Got it. Okay.
That's what gets them beyond themselves. And then we teach them a meditation called the blessing of the energy centers. And that, of course, begins to cause their autonomic nervous system to move back into balance. And that's a good way for them to start their day.
That's fantastic. I loved what you said in, I think it was one of your talks, in your meditation in the morning, and maybe this is your practice, which I want to ask you about before we close, but you said, ask yourself every morning, what is the greatest expression of yourself that you can be today? And I just thought that was so beautiful.
Well, that's how I start every day. I think, well, I'm going to present myself to the world today. Who do I want to be when I open my eyes? What is the greatest ideal of myself? And in order for us to do that, we have to begin to become conscious of who we are first. You know, if you're feeling unhappy, that's not going to work. If you're feeling like you're rushing and you got to get up and do things, you're not in the present moment, that's not going to work. If you have a bad attitude that day and you have these crazy thoughts, that's not going to work either. So that's the part of you that you have to begin to overcome. So I always look at where I'm at and get so conscious that these thoughts, behaviors, and emotions aren't going to be part of my day. And I get so conscious of them that I would never let myself go unconscious to them. And then I begin to decide who I want to be. And I start thinking the way I want to think, and I start rehearsing how I want to act and what I'm going to do during that day. And then I start to really open my heart and really begin to feel. Turns out when you do that properly, you begin to change your energy. And after all these years, I can tell you, nobody changes until they change their energy. And when you change your energy, you change your life. And that's kind of where you start seeing those magical things start to happen around you. And you start going, wow, I'm in the flow. There's a synchronicity. There's a movement in my life effortlessly. And I think that's what everybody wants to do, stay in that kind of zone. And it just takes practice.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you give people back their own power with a lot of these lessons and techniques and with your wisdom.
I hope so.
You also talk about this idea of continuing to learn so that your brain continues to grow, and maybe that's a little bit about neuroplasticity. How does that play into your work? And what do you sort of advise the people that come to your workshops to do to keep their brains super active?
Well, knowledge is power. Knowledge about yourself is self-empowerment. I mean, combine a little neuroscience with a little quantum physics, with a little neuroendocrinology, with a little psychoneuroimmunology, a little epigenetics, and make it simple. And I now know that when you give people sound scientific information, and science is the contemporary language of mysticism, and you can present it in a way that they can understand, and every time you learn something new, you make new connections in your brain. And the research shows that 1 hour of focused concentration on a concept or an idea doubles the number of connections in your brain. I mean, that's a physical change that's taking place. But if you don't review that information, if you don't repeat it, you don't think about it, those circuits prune apart within hours or days. So what we do is we teach people the information, and then we ask them to turn to the person next to them and explain it and wire it in their brain. If they can't explain that model of information, then it's not wired in there. So we build a model, mm-hmm. they turn to the person next to them, they explain it. Then we add more to the model, they explain a little bit more. And then all of a sudden, as they start explaining this model, firing and wiring over and over again, if learning is making new synaptic connections, then remembering is maintaining and sustaining them. So now they're beginning to install the neurological hardware in their brain in preparation for the experience. Set up the conditions in their environment and give them the proper instruction. Many of those people are going to get their behaviors to match their intentions and their actions equal to their thoughts. And when they do, the whole purpose of this is to have a new experience. The experience then enriches the philosophical circuits in the brain. And then once those neurons string into place, the brain makes a chemical. And the chemical is called a feeling or an emotion. And now, the moment you feel unlimited, the moment you feel joyful, the moment you feel inspired, the moment you feel compassion, now you are teaching your body chemically to understand what your mind is intellectually understood. So we can say that knowledge is for the mind and experience is for the body. And in that moment, you're embodying the truth of that philosophy. It's no longer intellectual data. Now the body is literally getting the information, and now you're beginning to rewrite the biological program. So then if you've done it once, you should be able to do it again. And if you can repeat it over and over again, you're going to begin to neurochemically condition your mind and body to begin to work as one. And when the body now knows how to do it as well as the mind, now it's a habit, it's a skill, it's innate in you, it's second nature, it's who you are. You're in a state of being, and you're mastering now that philosophy. So then now the person is in a state where they're memorized an internal order that's greater than any of the conditions in their outer environment. And that's when they begin to master their environment. So I now know that if people understand the what and the why, the how gets easier. And knowledge is the precursor to experience. And so the more knowledge you have, the more prepared you are for an event. Now that's point A. Point B is if you want to be wealthy, you want to be healthy, you want to be free, you want to be in love, start filling your brain with knowledge. Don't watch stupid television shows that make it some way that isn't the truth. Find out that wealthy people took a lot of hard knocks and had a lot of failures, but they persisted. Find out what the qualities that made them so great. You want to be a leader? Study great leaders in history, and you'll find out that they were in tremendous adversity their whole life. And when you start realizing other people have done it, and you begin to identify with them, the knowledge acts as raw materials for you to build a bigger model of understanding. And now you have more information for transformation. And so I think the more you fill your brain with knowledge, the more you add new stitches into the three-dimensional tapestry of your gray matter. And that's what causes you to make your brain fire in new sequences and new patterns and new combinations. And whenever you make your brain work differently, you're changing your mind. So that's the name of the game.
I mean, I just feel like there's so much for people to learn about this, but it's so intuitive, really. I think it has the power to really help people make big changes in their lives, not just heal chronic pain or conditions, but to shift habits. And
you change your personality, you change your life. I mean, that's, we've seen that thousands of times, and it may be when the person finally overcomes a certain emotion, their disease goes away because they're no longer signaling the same gene. The moment they stop living in an unconscious habit and they get over that habit, it's very, very likely that they're going to have a huge shift, an opportunity in a job or a relationship that they never had before because they freed energy up. And so I've done my best to be able to demystify the process so that people have within their reach all the tools to create a better life for themselves. But I think we innately already know how to do this. It's just, we want to make it a skill.
Thank you so much for being on our show today. I'm so grateful.
Thank you, Patricia. It was an honor.
Thanks so much to Dr. Joe for being with us today. You can find his most recent book, Becoming Supernatural: How Common People Are Doing the Uncommon, at all major booksellers. His website is drjoedispenza.com. If you have feedback or suggestions for guests, email us at patricia@meditationstudioapp.com. And don't forget to download Meditation Studio in the App Store. We'll see you next time.